This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I just want to talk a little bit about the genealogy of this translation and of my relationship to Benjamin. So, little history. My first contact with Benjamin was at the end of my junior year as a complet major at the University of Chicago. Benjamin's Illuminations, with an introduction by Hannah Arendt, had just been published by Schocken Books in the spring of 1969, and as if this had been a major new album by Dylan or the Beatles or the Stones, we all dropped everything we were reading or studying to plunge ourselves into a rapt audition of Harry Zone's translations of Unpacking My Library, The Task of the Translator, The Storyteller, the essays on Kafka, Brecht, Baudelaire, Proust, as well as the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction, as it was then called. It's now turned into the work of art in the age of technological reproducibility. Bit of history of translation. Bachkite. And, of course, the thesis on the philosophy of history. 4 years later, now a grad student at Harvard, I did my first translation of Benjamin, a Raubdruck, as they say in German, i.e. a completely illegal, pirated version of his essay of Hashish in Marseille, which was published in a fall 1973 issue of the Minnesota Review, edited by the then still rather young Frederick Jameson. This is one of Benjamin's most interesting city texts, or Städtebilder, as they're sometimes called, which was first published in 1932, and there's a definite relation between Benjamin's stoned progress through Marseille and his general disorientation in Moscow, all of which go back, I think, to Aragon's preface to his Paysan de Paris, in which he underscores the importance philosophically not only of the relationship of error to truth, but of errancy in relationship to the discovery of a certain truth about the city. So actually the epiphanic or profane illuminations of surrealism and hashish, I think, need to be possibly related to a profound Benjamin disorientation in Moscow. My next foray into Benjamin came 10 years later. I was contacted by Gary Smith, still then a grad student finishing up his thesis on Benjamin's aesthetics at Boston University, to translate a section of the Passagenwerk, namely the fiendishly difficult N on the theory of knowledge or theory of progress. This appeared in a special Benjamin issue of Philosophical Forum in 1983 and was, I believe, the first portion of the Arcades project ever to be published in English. As a result of all of this, in the spring of 1985, I was approached by Annette Michelson of October Magazine to translate Benjamin's Moscow Diary, a separate edition of which had been published by Surkamp in 1980, edited by the same Gary Smith, who, still an American graduate student, had been given access to the manuscript held in the Adorno Archive in Frankfurt by Rolf Tiedemann. Tiedemann had decided to hold off the publication of the diary until the death of Asialasis in 1979, and Gary Smith had also traveled to Jerusalem to carefully go over the manuscript and complete its annotations with Gershom Scholem, who eventually provided the preface to the German edition of 1980. And we have in the exhibit a facsimile of one of the pages of this manuscript, which actually comes to a total of 56 pages pages in its original German, an absolute feat of Benjaminian compression. Toward the end of the manuscript, each page features as many as 1,100 words in minuscule fraktur script. This is a philological nightmare. Of course, Benjamin's model was the complete Torah on the size of a fingernail. At any rate, I assume that if October was interested in publishing a translation of Moscow Diary, it was largely at the initiative of Annette Michelson, a Russian film scholar who had founded the film studies department at NYU, where I was now teaching in the early 70s, with the great Eisenstein and Whitman scholar Jay Leda, whom too many of us have forgotten. Annette had just edited Kino Eye, the writings of Dziga Vertov, in 1984, and had no doubt picked up on the allusions to Vertov in Benjamin's diary, where he mentioned seeing the latter's One-Sixth of the World, a panorama of the ethnic diversity of the USSR in early 1927, typically admitting, quote, "but there was much that escaped me." He also mentions seeing Eisenstein's battleship Potemkin, about which he writes a short text attacking a certain Schmitz's critique of the movie contained on the very final page of the Moscow Diary manuscript. So the Russian film context, especially in the light of Benjamin's later 1936 essay on the work of art in the age of its technological reproducibility, is very important, as is everything related to images moving or not, and images shot through by technology or technicity. In fact, it should be remembered, between 1928 and 1930, a period during which Azalassis will actually live with Benjamin for 2 years in Berlin, she works at the Soviet embassy as the trade rep for Soviet films. At any rate, I spent 2 months of the summer of 1985 translating the Moscow Diary for my Octoberists. I remember it was a blistering hot summer in New York City, and I had the AC blasting for most of the time in order to approximate 2 months of Moscow winter that I was imaginatively living. And the time it took to do my translation being approximately identical to the time span, i.e. early December 1927 through late January 1928, covered by the diary. Every day of Benjamin's writing paralleling every day of my translating. It was, by the way, my first translation on an ancient Mac computer, so I was sort of magnificently sight-reading my translation of the diary, as it were, rewriting along with him. What really drew me to this text was the challenge of capturing Benjamin's first-person voice, or more precisely, the relationship of the I of the text to the temporality of its writing, and indeed to the larger historicity of late 1926, early 1927, a crucial interval falling between the aftermath of the Russian Revolution and the inception of Stalinization. And at the very core of the Moscow Diary is indeed the experience of time and temporality. And I'm going to read just a little quote from Benjamin's rewrite of the diary into an essay called Moscow, which he published in Martin Buber's magazine, Die de créateur about Russian temporality, that nothing turns out as was intended and expected. This banal expression of the reality of life here asserts itself in each individual case so inviolably and intensely that Russian fatalism becomes comprehensible. A feeling for the value of time, notwithstanding all rationalization, is not met with even in the capital of Russia. TRUD, the Trade Union Institute for the Study of Work under its director, Gustiev, launched a poster campaign for punctuality. From the earliest times, a large number of clockmakers have been settled in Moscow. They are crowded in the manner of medieval guilds in a particular streets on the Kuznetsky Bridge or Ulitsa Gertsena. One wonders who actually needs them. Time is money. For this astonishing statement, posters claim the authority of Lenin. So alien is the idea to the Russians. They fritter everything away. One is tempted to say that minutes are the cheap liquor which they can never get enough of, that they are tipsy with time. If on a street a scene is being shot for a film, they forget where they are going or why and follow the camera for hours, arriving at the office distraught. In his use of time, therefore, the Russian will remain Asiatic longest of all. The real unit of time is the сейчас. Сейчас? Yeah, this means at once. You can hear it 10, 20, 30 times and wait hours, days, or weeks until the promise is carried out. Just as seldom as you hear the answer, no. Negative replies are left to time. Time catastrophes, time collisions are therefore as much of the order of that day as is the remonte. They make each hour superabundant, each day exhausting, each life a moment. So these are in his rewrite for the Buber magazine article, a kind of a condensation of remarks that are scattered throughout the Moscow diary in relationship to temporality. And this has very much to do with the very diaristic form of this text. The Moscow Diary is unusual in Benjamin's corpus in being the single most extended first piece and work of diaristic prose. If you look at volume 6 of the German edition of Benjamin's collected works devoted to his autobiographical writings, you'll see there are any number of short, unfinished diaries chronicling his travels or his holiday trips in 1911, 1912, and a practice which will continue on into the 30s. But so Benjamin, from very early on, is obsessed with the notion of the Tagebuch, of the daybook, or of the diary. And I just went back to his really interesting 1913 essay, which is part of a larger essay called The Metaphysics of Youth, whose second section is devoted to the diary, to the Tagebuch. It's a fascinating text, and it's based on the notion of Abstand, which translates as interval, but which also means in German distance, the standing away from or standing far from something or somebody. And so this is what he writes in his short essay, The Diary, in 1913, and it might be interesting for our discussion of the Moscow Diary. This believer writes his diary, and he writes it at intervals, in Abstände, and will never complete it because he will die. What is the interval in the diary? It does not operate in developmental time, for that has been overcome, aufgehoben. It does not operate in time at all, for time is liquidated. Instead, it is a book of time, daybook, book of days. This transmits the rays of his knowledge through space. in the diary, there is no chain of experience, for then it would not be without interval. This goes later to Benjamin's critique of progress in Actually N. Instead, time is overcome and overcome to Aufgehoben. Tu is the self that acts in time. I am entirely transposed into time. It irradiates me. Nothing further can befall this self, this creation of time. Everything else to which time happens yields to it, for to everything else our self happens as time. The eye befalls all things. In the diary, they impinge on the eye and live in it, but time no longer happens to this self, to the birth of immortal time. The timeless befalls it. All things are gathered in it, are within it. It lives all-powerful in the interval. In the interval, the diary's silence, the eye encounters its own time, the pure time, reine Zeit, reine Sprache, later in the translator essay. In the interval, it is gathered into itself. No thing intrudes into its immortal being with. I won't go on, but you can. This is a Benjamin who's still very much into Bergson, and you can hear Bergsonian durée, the past prolonged and the present and the future, what Benjamin calls immortal time, in opposition to developmental time, mechanical time, the time of chains of causation, the time of the calendar, the clock, the stock exchange. In this early text, pure time flows intermittently within every day of chronological time, but the chain of experience is overcome or aufgehoben in the radiation of youthful time, of pure time, the intervallic time of the diary, which is the site of the simultaneous dissolution and fulfillment of the self as something experienced at a distance, in Abstand, or in this interval, which is silence or death. Or time is therefore experienced as space, as landscape, later as cityscape, in which things see us or radically look back to us. So in this early text, the diary is seen as a path through a landscape of events in which we, quote, befall ourselves, in which we happen to ourselves, and in this spatio-temporal dialectic, the diary renders past things futural and lets us encounter ourselves as our most immediate enemy, as conscience, as pure self, in, quote, the time of death. So this sovereign reality of death, at once distant and near, for an instant bestows immortality on the living. As an entry into momentary redemption, the diary inscribes a fate in the form of the resurrection of self. So what we have here is actually an early Benjaminian theory of autothanatography, right? Not autobiography, but autothanatography. And he says quite explicitly in this very early essay, he's 18, anyone who reads a diary falls asleep over it and fulfills what was the fate of its writer. Again and again, the diary evokes the death of its writer, if only in the sleep of the one reading. Our diary knows only one reader, and he becomes the redeemer as he is mastered by the book. We ourselves are the reader or our own enemy. This enemy has found no entry into the kingdom that flowered around us. He is none other than the banished, purified I dwelling invisibly in the midpoint of times. Now, what's interesting is that the diary also causes, via this intervallic experience of death, of silence, causes temporality to transform itself into a particular form of spatiality, or what Benjamin calls landscape, and later will emerge in his Städtebilder, his city writings, or his Denkbilder, his thought images as Landschaft. And this Landschaft is absolutely related to a place of a resurrection of self when time sends forth its ever-widening waves. This is the landscape. All that happens surrounds us as landscape, for we, the time of things, know no times, nothing but the leaning of trees, the horizon, and the sharply etched mountain ridges, which suddenly awake, full of meaning insofar as they position us in their midst at the center. The landscape transports us into the midst, trembling trees stops beset us with questions, valleys envelop us with mist, unimaginable houses oppress us with their shapes. We, their midpoint, befall these things, but from all the time in which we tremble, there remains to us within one question: are we time? Pride tempts us to answer yes, and then the landscape would disappear. We would be citizens, but the spell of the book bids us to be silence. The only answer is that we trace our path. And we can talk a little bit about this in terms of sort of the ways in which Benjamin will experience Moscow as cityscape. What's also interesting and totally proleptic and prophetic in this early text is that this landscape, since we're talking about fragments of a lover's discourse, this landscape is saturated with the figure of the beloved. The landscape sends us the beloved. We encounter nothing that is not in the landscape, and in it nothing but future. It knows only the one girl who is already a woman, he's 18, for she enters the diary with a history of her future. Now this gets very Rilkean. Malta, Lawrence Brigger. We already died once together. We were already wholly identical once with that history. If we have met with it in death, then it comes to meet us in life countless times. From the vantage point of death, every girl is the beloved woman who always encounters us sleepers in the diary. I mean, this is already Orpheus. This is the shape of love in the diary. We encounter it in the landscape beneath a very bright sky. Passion has slept its fill between us, and the woman is a girl, since in her youthfulness she restores us our unspent time, which she has gathered in her death. The plunging nakedness that overwhelms us in the landscape is balanced by the naked beloved. I'm going to stop here, but the next step, and I hope it will come out of discussion, is that this girl woman predicted in this text about sort of the intersection, the metamorphosis of sort of time into space, into Landschaft, in the resurrectional sort of space of the diary, is already Asia Lassus. And the next step would have been to do a kind of reading of the great 1925 text on Naples, which Benjamin co-wrote with Asia Lassus, and whose central term is indeed porosité, which is a kind of interstitial overcoming or flowing through of thresholds between either the private and the public, between the center and periphery, between any number of dialectical opposites that you could set up, which for me is actually the phenotext of the Moscow Diary, which is saturated with Asia Lassus. And so I've just tried to link this early, very youthful 1913 text with then the Naples text and the central in which the notion of interval modulates into the notion of porosity. Benjamin Lassus used the Latinate term porositet for that, and the way in which then we can recover all of that in the Moscow Diary.